some more introductory remarks. You know, lots of times you hear pastors, or I have, say, you know, I had two sermons on my mind. I just didn't know which one to pick. And I always thought, oh, how does that happen? But that's what happened to me this time. And so it was almost going to be Romans 6, which is a great passage to preach from. I was talking to Joel Wednesday about this one. He's like, we decided to go, let's go with this one in light of some of our recent events. But I think Romans 6 would have been easier to preach. So again, pray for me. it happens to be that I have just completed my read through the Bible maybe a month ago. I'm not necessarily pegged to the new year. And so although I'm on a, you know, every now and then you're going to miss a day or something. And so I just pick up right where you're going. And for those of you who try to read like 16 chapters in a day to catch up, God, I'll pray for you. But I just happened to turn over, and I'm going through a chronological read, and I happened to be on the story of Joseph. And I always find the story of Joseph so fascinating, and it's a story that we all know. It's a story that we're familiar with. So the challenge today is going to be to throw aside our familiarity and to really kind of try to put ourselves into the story and think about it. I would recommend, as you're reading the Bible, that you read through the Bible at a fast pace, because that's going to help you try to connect everything. And I would recommend you read through at a slow pace, and you really dig deep and get some of those nuggets. And a medium pace. We should be reading the Bible, you know, for context. So we should change our lens so that we are, you know, really digging deep into, you know, what does this mean? But we also want to be able to see the big picture. And as we do that, I think we'll see God's hand moving through the pages of Scripture, and we've talked about that in our Sunday school. So today, as I said, we're going to be talking about the story of Joseph, and I do want to start out with one caveat. Whenever we're reading a story from the Old Testament, we need to take care that we recognize that this is a descriptive story, and not everything in there would be prescriptive for us. And so we need to take all of the word into account and to balance out what we see. So we wouldn't see that, you know, David's taking, you know, 700 wives and think that's prescriptive for us today, right? It's just descriptive of what happened back then. Recent events. I think we all know about the tragedy in, I think it's Uvalde, Texas, and the shooting that occurred there. So this happens March 24th, and it coincides with Joseph being sold into slavery in my daily reading and the questions that come when a tragedy strikes us. And I'm assuming that none of us are probably personally connected to anyone in that town. But regardless, we all have our own struggles. We had family lose a father. Tim lost a father. Dealing with various trials and tribulations. And so the question comes, why do these bad things happen to, might I say, good people, although we know we're not good people? How do we respond to them? And what is God doing through them? And in a move that is kind of out of character for me, I'm going to start with application first, right? We're going to put application up front. So here's what I want to say about bad events that happen, and specifically the shooting tragedy in Texas. What occurred on May 24th in Uvalde, Texas, at the Robb Elementary School was evil. We can call it evil. We can say this is evil. We know that we are called not to take human life, Exodus 20:13. We also know, this is the second point, God never tempts us to do evil. James 1:13 says, no one undergoing a trial should say, I am being tempted by God, since God is not tempted by evil, and he himself doesn't tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when he is drawn away and enticed by his own desire. Point three, God does, however, allow and orchestrate evil so that he may accomplish his good ends. That's tough sometimes for us to think about, especially when we're the one who've experienced the trial or the tribulation. Isaiah 46:9, one of my favorite sections of verse, it says, "Remember what happened long ago, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is no one like me. I declare the end from the beginning, and from long ago what is not yet done, saying, my plan will take place, and I will do my will." How does he do it? "I call a bird of prey from the east, a man of my purpose from a far country. Yes, I have spoken, so I will bring it about. I have planned it. I also will do it." See, God knows each one of us and knows the evil intentions of some. And when he releases his restraint from that, he knows that the evil is going to come about. And he uses that, even though he doesn't tempt to that, he uses that to bring about his good ends. Fourth, God does not, nor does he promise to reveal all that he will accomplish through that evil. Think about Deuteronomy 29:29. It's a favorite verse of questioners in master's class. It says that the hidden things are of God, right? He doesn't reveal everything. We can think back to Job and the trials that fall on Job. And he says, "I just want an audience before God. I want to ask him." Of course, and God says, "Let me ask you some questions, Job," right? And he doesn't get the answers for that. The fifth application, amid trials, difficult times, evil that befalls us, we are to rejoice. We're to trust. And we're to allow proper authorities, that would be government, that would be God, to enact the punishment and the vengeance that's due for the evil. Unless it's natural evil. All right, so we're going to read and talk about the story of Joseph. I'm not going to read it all to you because this is a long story, but I do want to cover the main parts of the story. So if you are a student of the Bible, you know that the first time we see or hear of Joseph, it's when Rachel gives birth to him. And of course, this brings joy to Jacob's heart because Rachel is the wife that he loves in chapter 33. And that's in chapter 30. In chapter 33, we see Rachel and Joseph and Jacob, and I'll call Jacob and Israel, so you just kind of have to have patience with me, because the Bible calls him both Jacob and Israel in this part. We see the three of them at the end of this long train going to meet who? Esau, right? And so this long train of people, you know, Jacob is concerned about how he's going to be received by Esau. And so you have his wife that he loves, his son that he loves at this very long train. And that speaks of the protection because, you know, Jacob wants to be able to move out if something goes sideways with that reunion. And it also speaks of Joseph's favored spot even from this early age. Now, I've always thought when I've pictured the 12 sons of Jacob, that there's a pretty wide age spread. But if you think about it, Joseph is born before they ever leave Laban. And when Joseph is born, that's at the end of his time, his second 7 years. So we have the first 11 sons within a 7-year period. So they're fairly tightly packed. I always imagine Reuben being like, you know, 10, 15 years older than Joseph, but that's not the case. All right, so we really get into the heart of Joseph's story in chapter 37. And now Joseph is 17. Do we have any 17-year-olds in here? Hudson, are you 17? Yeah. So Isaac, yes, we got some 17-year-olds. So what we see is Joseph is dreaming that he could be in charge of everything. And I think that's every 17-year-old's dream, right? That was my dream. I thought when I was 17 that I knew everything that I needed to know, and I could tell my parents and my siblings what should happen. But Joseph is quite literally dreaming these dreams. He's going to dream that he is a stalk a sheaf of wheat, and all the other sheaves are going to bow down to him. And he's also going to dream that the stars, there's 11 stars, and the sun and the moon are bowing down to him. Think about this in our own culture. If your 17-year-old said, "Mom, Dad, older brothers and siblings, you're going to bow down to me. And the kind of the affront that would be for us, how much more multiplied in this culture would that be? But Scripture says that Jacob pondered these things. He kind of rebukes him, but he ponders him. All right. And so let's read this section. I'm going to be reading some, and we're going to be summarizing some as we go through this section. So this would be chapter 37. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. These are the family records of Jacob. At 17 years of age, Joseph tended sheep with his brothers. The young man was working with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought a bad report about them to their father. So already we have the younger brother telling on the older brothers. You can see the tension is here. Now Israel, that's Jacob, loved Joseph more than his other sons because Joseph was a son born to him in his old age, and he made a long-sleeved robe for him. Anyone have anything different than long-sleeved? Most of you probably have multicolored. So there, what's that?
Very colored.
So there is some, I'd always grown up with multicolored, but there is some debate about what is actually going on. Is it multicolored? Is it striped? Is it long-sleeved? Some of the more recent scholarship thinks that it's a long-sleeve robe that would go down to the end of your arms and down to your ankles, and it would be a robe that would signify you're not working in the fields, because you can't work in the fields if you've got a long robe like this. You're kind of set above everyone. So again, you might see how this might anger older brothers. If your younger brother is given this robe that says, hey, I'm kind of in a managerial position. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him. They could not bring themselves to speak peaceably to him. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And you can see that, this dream that would come to them. All right, so we're going to skip that, and we're going to keep summarizing here. So Joseph is sent down to check on his brothers in 37:12 through 36. And I've always wondered, maybe it's just me, but I think if you're reading with an eye to what's going on, is Joseph sent just to give them provisions? Is he sent to check on them to make sure they're doing their work well? You can see how that might have made them even more angry. But he's going to give a report back, maybe, to Jacob. And so from a distance, his brothers see him coming, and they plot to do evil. Now we see that Reuben is going to stay their desire to murder him. He's going to stop that. And he's going to say, let's just throw him in a pit. And Reuben wants to save him out of this pit. And we're not told all the details. We're told that they sit down to eat and that Reuben goes away, apparently because he's not there. And so Judah has the idea that we're going to sell him into slavery. And again, is this Judah's way of rescuing him? We don't know. What's Judah's motivation here? I wonder, is Judah rescuing him from certain death in his mind, or is he being greedy and wanting money? We're not told. I think, this is just my speculation, I think Judah is probably trying to save him. I think Simeon is the ringleader because of what we're going to see later on in the story. But that's speculation on my part. All right, so we see the first major evil befall Joseph here. He's thrown into a pit. He's done what his father has asked him to do. His brothers are going to kill an animal, soil his robe, send it back to his father and say, is this Joseph's robe? If it is, he was probably killed. And he's sold to Ishmaelites, Midianites, down into slavery into Egypt. You ever wanted to sell a sibling into slavery? Can you imagine? We see later on in the story them recalling the anguish with which he cried out to them. Can you imagine being the one in the pit, being bound, sold into slavery, and what that would have felt like? And yet, Scripture doesn't record anything negative that Joseph says to them. Doesn't record anything negative that he has towards God. So we don't get all of the details, but from what we can tell, there's no record of him rebelling against that. So we know what happens next. He's sold to Potiphar, and he's put in charge of everything in Potiphar's household. And he does a good job. Maybe this skill that he exercises with Potiphar and the skill that we're going to see him exercise later on with Pharaoh is the same skill that Jacob saw and put him in charge of the flocks and giving bad reports. We don't know. Again, it's speculation on my part. But I think that this is, he's just a gifted guy who manages things well. So we see Potiphar's wife. Let's read. He's put in charge of everything up to the point where it says Potiphar doesn't even care about anything other than what's he going to eat, which is a good thing for him to care about, right? So let's pick up and read about the second major evil that befalls him, chapter 39, verses 7 through 20. After some time, his wife's master looked longingly at Joseph and said, "Sleep with me," but he refused. "Look," he said to his master's wife, "with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in his house, and he has put all that he owns under my authority. No one in the house is greater than I. He's withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. So how could I do this immense evil, and how could I sin against God?" Although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her. Now one day he went into the house to do his work, and none of the household servants were there. She grabbed him by his garment and said, "Sleep with me." But leaving his garment in her hand, he escaped and ran outside. When she saw that he had left his garment with her and ran outside, she called to her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "my husband brought a Hebrew man to make fools of us. He came to me so that he could sleep with me, and I screamed as loud as I could. When he heard me screaming for help, he left his garment beside me and ran outside." So she reports this. Potiphar gets this. We're told that he's extremely angry. I always wonder, you know, does he suspect that maybe his wife isn't on the up and up? But he's extremely angry, and he puts Joseph in prison. And again, we're told Joseph, true to form, is put in charge of stuff. And he manages it well so that the prison guard is pleased with him and he's in charge of everything. And so we see God's hand with Joseph through this second evil act against him. In prison, we all know the story, there's a chief baker and a chief cupbearer that come to him. And we don't really know how long Joseph is in prison here. But they have offended Pharaoh somehow, and they both start having these dreams. And Joseph, again, the interpreter of dreams, says, "God can give an interpretation, tell it to me." And so we see through those dreams that the cupbearer in 3 days' time is going to be restored to Pharaoh's service. And we see that the baker, his head's going to be lifted up too, but in a dramatically different fashion. He's going to be executed by Pharaoh. And he tells the cupbearer, "Please remember me when you get back restored to Pharaoh." Of course, the cupbearer doesn't. So I would say this is not a major evil, but it is a slight against him. Like, he's gone through this. He has given this interpretation, and it all comes to pass, and yet he is not remembered. So here we have really God setting the scene, what I think, for Joseph to be exalted to this final position. So we get to the kind of the next chapter of both the book and Joseph's life, and Pharaoh starts having these dreams. We remember what his dreams were: 7 healthy, good-looking cows down by the Nile. And they're grazing, and now there are 7 very weak cows, and the 7 healthy cows are eaten by the weak sickly looking cows, and the sickly cows don't get any better looking. They just stay the same. And then the similar thing with ears of corn. And this really frightened Pharaoh. So let's pick up in reading 41, verse 33. So now let Pharaoh look. Oh, so that's a little ahead of our story. So we see that Joseph is called in because the cupbearer remembers that, hey, there's this guy that interpreted this dream for me. And so we see that Joseph interprets the dream, and he makes it known that these seven cows, these 7 ears of corn, stand for 7 years of plenty. What I find amazing is that during the 7 years of plenty, there's going to be more than 5 times enough grain for each year produced. So if you read the story, each year when Joseph is put into play, he takes a fifth of it and saves it. Just a fifth of what's produced each year and saves it. And Scripture says it's more than the sands of the sea. It's beyond measure, right? So he interprets it, and now Joseph is set up and put in place. Let's pick that up in 33. So now let Pharaoh look for discerning and wise men. Set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this. Let him appoint overseers over the land and take a fifth of the harvest of the land of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. Let them gather all the excess food during these good years that are coming. Under Pharaoh's authority, store the grain in the cities so that they preserve it as food. The food will be a reserve for the land during the 7 years of famine that will take place in the land of Egypt. Then the country will not be wiped out by the famine. So we turn to the famine hitting, and 2 years into the famine, it's hitting everywhere, right? And the sons of Jacob are starving. And so now we're going to really kind of get to what I consider the heart of the story. It's Joseph's reunion with his brothers. So let's read chapter 42. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you keep looking at each other? Listen," he went on, "I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us, that we will live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he thought something might happen to him. The sons of Israel were among those who came to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Joseph was in charge of the country. He sold grain to all its people. His brothers came and bowed down before him with their faces to the ground. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. "From the land of Canaan to buy food," they replied. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Joseph remembered his dreams about them and said to them, "You are spies. You have come here to see the weakness of the land." "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food," they said. "We are all sons of one man. We are honest. Your servants are not spies." "No," he said to them, "you have come to see the weakness of the land." But they replied, "We, your servants, were 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and one is no longer living." Then Joseph said to them, "I have spoken. You are spies. This is how you will be tested. As surely as Pharaoh lives, you will not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one from among you to get your brother. The rest of you will be imprisoned so that your words can be tested to see if they are true. If they are not, then as surely as Pharaoh lives, you are spies." So we see they're imprisoned for 3 days. And I'm always curious about, you know, this what's going on here. You wonder what's going through their mind. Now they're in prison and they're thinking, this is coming back to them. And the dreams that he had, he says that he remembered that. We see Joseph testing them. And Joseph at this point in time is, you know, at the very beginning of our application, he is, in some sense, a proper authority. I wonder if he's wanting to test to see if their hearts have changed, right? See if they have repented for this. But Joseph is still tender towards them. He turns around, he hears them talking, he weeps. And you also wonder about this conspiracy. How long had these brothers kept up this lie? Who all knows about this lie? It quickly comes off on one of them's dead. You wonder if they had just counted him for dead. Like, we don't really know where he is. We just count him for dead. So what happens is he comes back and he says, I fear God. And I want to do what's right. So I'm going to keep one of you here. Now, who is kept behind? You remember? Simeon. And I have to think that Simeon must have been the ringleader in all of this against Joseph. That's just my speculation. But whether Joseph picked Simeon or his brothers picked Simeon, you could see him go, you're the one that got us into all this trouble. You can stay behind and you can be here. And it's also funny, we'll read in a second, that when Jacob, they're going to go make this return trip, Jacob's not even really concerned. It's not mentioned that he's concerned with Simeon. He just doesn't want to lose Benjamin. So you wonder what kind of character Simeon was. So, all right, let's pick up in 43. So just kind of catch us up where we are here. They've gone back. They've gotten the grain, and they need more grain. Jacob doesn't want to send Benjamin down. So verse 1. Now the famine in the land was severe. When they had used up the grain they had brought back from Egypt, their father said to them, go back and buy us a little food. But Judah said to him, the man specifically warned us, you will not see me again unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy food. But if you will not send him, we will not go. For the man said to us, you will not see me again unless your brother is with you. Why have you caused me so much trouble? Israel asked. Why did you tell the man that you had a brother? It's an odd question. They answered, the man kept asking us about our family. Is your father still alive? Do you have another brother? And we answered him accordingly. How could we know that he would say, bring your brother here? Then Judah said to his father Israel, send the boy with me. We will be on our way so that we may live and not die, neither we nor you nor our dependents. I will be responsible for him. You can hold me personally accountable. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, I will be guilty before you forever. If we had not delayed, we could have come back twice by now. Then the father Israel said to them, if it must be so, do this. And so he instructs them, you know, to take really triple silver, if you read it right. The silver that they had gotten back from their first trip, double silver for this time, provisions of almonds and pistachios and honeys that they're going to give to this ruler who seems to be cross with them. So they're going to return to Egypt, and they're going to come to the house. And as soon as they arrive, Joseph recognizes them. He says, take them to my house. Of course, the dread probably is on them. That's what Scripture says. They remember that we got our silver back. So they say to the servant, here's your silver. And he says, I got my silver. It must have been a blessing from God. So then they come to eat, and we're going to see Joseph's final test in chapter 44. Joseph commanded his steward, fill the men's bag with as much food as they can carry, and put each one's silver at the top of his bag. Put my cup, the silver one, at the top of the youngest one's bag, along with the silver for his grain. So he did as Joseph told him. At morning light, the men were sent off with their donkeys. They had not gone very far from the city when Joseph said to his steward, get up, pursue them, and when you overtake them, say to them, why have you repaid evil for good? Isn't this the cup that my master drinks from and uses for divination? What you have done is wrong. When he overtook them, he said these words to them, and they said to him, why does my lord say these things? Your servants could not possibly have done such a thing. We even brought back to you from the land of Canaan the silver we found at the top of our bags. How could we steal silver or gold from your master's house? If it is found with one of us, your servants, he must die, and the rest of us will become my servant slaves. So we see, we'll skip some verses and we'll pick back up, but we follow that through. They check everyone's bag, go down. And it's in Benjamin's bag, which this is a great distress to all of them. And Judah says, take me. He says, no, we'll take them all back. And so we pick that up. But Judah approached him and said, my lord, please let your servant speak personally to my lord. Do not be angry with your servant, for you are like Pharaoh. My lord asked his servants, do you have a father or brother? And he goes on to say that this brother is, if we lose him, it'll kill my father. So we'll pick up in verse 45. Chapter 45. Joseph could no longer keep his composure in front of all of his attendants. So he called out, send everyone away from me. No one was with him when he revealed his identity to his brothers. But he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and also Pharaoh's household heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? But they could not answer him because they were terrified in his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, please come near me. And they came near. I am Joseph, your brother, he said, the one you sold into Egypt. And now don't be grieved or angry with yourselves for selling me here, because God sent me ahead of you to preserve life. So we see this amazing tenderness that Joseph has towards his brother. If we were to follow the story on, he's going to bring Jacob and his family down. They're going to have plenty to eat. They're set up separate in the land of Goshen. And if you were in our class in Sunday school, God is starting to keep his people separate as he allows the iniquity of those in Canaan to multiply. And then Jacob's going to die. And there's a concern that Joseph's just been nice to us because Jacob's alive. But now that Dad's gone, now we're going to feel the wrath of our brother. And so they send this message to him, say, hey, remember, Dad said, be nice to us. And he says these words that, frame this. What you meant for evil, God meant for good. So how do we deal with trials? How do we deal when bad things come our way? I think we look at Joseph. He's a great example of that. Let me reiterate some of our principles from the beginning. Evil happens, and we can call it evil. But in the midst of calling it evil, we can recognize that, one, God never tempts us to do evil. But God does use evil to bring about good. In Acts, Peter says, what you men meant for evil, God had planned before the foundation, the crucifixion of his son, to bring salvation to us all. God doesn't always reveal to us his plans or his purposes for the evil. And amid trials, we're called to rejoice, trust, and allow proper authorities, that would be government and God, to enact punishment. Joseph was never recorded to have a cross word or a bad attitude. Some of you may know that was one of the qualifications for names for Curtis's children. Am I right on that? So Joseph, one of his sons, never has any sin charged to him that we read. He wasn't trying to make a joke, but so how do we deal with trials? I would say become familiar with your scripture, because trials are all throughout it. Paul would say to rejoice always. Again, I say rejoice. Peter would say don't be surprised at the fiery trials that you find yourselves in. James would say, count it all joy. He would say, ask for wisdom. But when you ask, don't be double-minded. Be intent on what God's answer would be. Jesus would say that we will have tribulation in this world, but to take heart that he has overcome the world. So I want to give you two, as we close, two kind of opposing ideas. In philosophy, we would call them the intellectual problem of evil and the emotional problem of evil. But I think the Bible deals with both of them. At the end of Ephesians, Paul tells them to put on the armor, right? The spiritual armor, to stand firm against the scheme of the devils. And the first one is the belt of truth. We have to understand that this life was never intended to be a primrose path for us to walk. Just like Joseph experienced evils and setbacks, we're going to experience up and downs. And if you're a believer, as I've said before, this is the worst it gets. And some of it's pretty good, right? I had graduation yesterday. That was pretty enjoyable. But we have to transform our minds. How do we think about this life? Is it supposed to be this paradise? No. It is a time that God is going to hone us, to prune us, to prepare us, to try us. And that is the intellectual problem of evil, that we get our minds ready. But when we're going through the evil, lots of times we need that shield of faith. Peter would say at the end of 1 Peter to be humble during our trials, because God gives grace to the humble, but he opposes the proud. And you can't have faith, I think you can't be trusting God if you have an attitude of, I don't deserve this, right? When you're going through a hard time. But if we're humble and we have faith, we can submit to those things. So that's what I would leave you with during our trials, that you prepare your mind, that you stay on those scriptures that tell us how we are to act in those times. And then we prepare our heart that we would trust God and that we would know that he is going to bring some good about it. And we may not always know what that is, right? I'll pray.